In one trendy Denver neighborhood, right next to a golf course, we find an old home almost hidden in plain sight.
4401 West 50th Avenue.
Unkept bushes cover the windows. Overgrown trees consume the front porch.
He's been missing for more than a year.
Inside, a 69-year-old man.
He wouldn't look you in the eye.
An urban hermit who permanently shut himself off from society.
Basically disappeared.
So removed from life and people, nobody knew he vanished.
We do know police found a body.
A year after his family searched his home.
Well, there's no way he was there when we searched
it. Unsanitary conditions hindered their investigation.
A year after he was declared missing.
I'll be out with the health department.
The mystery of Chuck came to a bizarre end.
No more after the coroner's report.
Who's to blame? How does a man become...
He was found in his own home.
Lost at home.
So thank you so much for your time. And I know it's probably hard to talk about your dad like this. And I know it's difficult for you because he passed. And I really appreciate the fact that you guys are here being open with me. I think that's pretty cool. So my first question is, like, how you feel about this process? I mean, how do you feel about, you know, talking about this?
We were pretty reluctant.
Yeah. You
know, especially these three.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, the biggest thing is we didn't really want to make a spectacle out of our dad. He was very stuck to himself, and for us to be doing this is
like a big no-no to him.
Yeah, he would probably not be real happy about it.
Really, really pissed at us if he knew that we were talking anything about his life.
He's a very private person.
You know, the reason I wanted to do it was just to kind of bring awareness or get people thinking about it, I guess, a little bit more.
Yeah,
because it's just really horrible that anyone would have to live like that.
Die like that, if you ask me.
Live and die like that.
At this moment, I'm sitting at a table with four of Chuck's children in Thornton, which is a suburb north of Denver. We have a couple of television cameras recording in a kitchen as numerous photos of Chuck are scattered on the table before us. I can see the resemblance of Chuck in each of their faces. It's taken a while and some convincing on my part for all of us to get to this moment. An on-the-record discussion about their dad, a TV interview for a story on the news. Susan is the oldest, with three of her brothers. Kevin, Jeff, who you heard from in episode 3, and the youngest, Brian. We're in Brian's house, which looks like a suburban home you'd see in a Tide commercial. It's well decorated and clean inside and out, the complete opposite of Chuck's home. We talk for more than an hour.
When we first went in, I was in shock. I was like, I can't believe he didn't come to one of us and say, hey man, you know, help me, or, you know, I mean, any one of us would have took him in a second if we knew he was living like that.
It was heartbreaking, to see how he was living.
You know, you go over to his house, you knock on the door, he comes out, he doesn't let you in the house, you know, so we didn't know that he was living as bad as he was, really.
What would you like to get out of this during our discussion here about your dad?
Answers. There's just been so many weird things with this whole case, like, why did it take so long to find him? That's what I want to know. And what happened to him? How did he die?
Yeah, the autopsy report came back as unknown. You know, we had searched the house a year ago and didn't find anything. Apparently they go in and now they find a body and we haven't gotten any answers really.
Yeah, we were all just like this right now. We were standing in there talking, going, okay, so where is he?
Yeah.
If he's not here, where is he?
When did you guys do that?
That was a year ago.
Okay. February 14th.
February 14th.
Right. That's when he was declared missing by the police department.
Right. Well, no, that's when we went in. The cops didn't go in the house that day. We went in. They met us there, but we went in and searched.
Brian and Jeff, you guys went into the house.
Correct.
Yeah, we went in with flashlights. Yeah. It was like midnight, I think, when we went in there. And we looked around and didn't find anything. We went back the next day. Still didn't find anything. Searched the whole house. We took some pictures and stuff and all that. And then where they claim to have found him, I feel convinced there's no way he was there in that location. But if he was, he was completely buried. If he was there, he was 100% completely buried, which seems unlikely to me that that could happen.
Yeah, you'd think we would have seen, like you said, a skull or...
Clothing, something.
Clothing, something.
Let's pause for a few seconds. A quick recap of the timeline. Chuck's sons searched his home for the first time in February of 2017, 1 year and 10 days before his body was found in his living room. Jeff told us in episode 3 a little bit about what they did when they first learned their dad was missing. The family goes into a little bit more detail here.
What was the thing that prompted you guys to go back in February of 2017 to go try to find your father?
Well, a guy came and knocked on my door on Valentine's Day.
That was this house here?
Yep, this house here, yep. He knocked on the door at like 9 o'clock at night, which was weird, but he just said he was a neighbor of my dad's and they haven't seen him in months. So he thought that he was missing.
He said he was a neighbor of your dad's?
Yeah, or his mom was a neighbor of my dad's or something like that.
So this guy, he comes to your door and he says, hey, I know your dad. I think he's either missing or he's dead.
Correct.
I think he told you that he thought he was dead in the house, didn't he?
Oh, that's right. He did say that. And that's what made us call the cops.
Yeah, he called me and told me that.
They told us to go into the house. First, Jeff's actually the one that called the cops.
And we did that on the way down there. This is like Valentine's Day night, and we're heading down there at like 10:30 at night. You know, calling the cops, say, hey, meet us down there.
Yeah, this all happened within like a 2-hour process. I mean,
it
was quick.
I'm really intrigued by this mystery guy who knocked on Brian's door claiming he knew Chuck. When I first met Brian weeks before the discussion, he gave me a number this guy left him that night. After searching some public records, I am positive it belongs to a guy named Mike. For now, I call him Mystery
Mike. So this Mike guy, you gave me his number early.
Yep.
I think I was able to track him down. I have his mugshot. I'm gonna see, is this the Mike guy that came to your door?
That looks really close to him,
like
I think.
The ID that you had, huh?
I would have to look at the picture of his ID.
So Mike Galushin, when we do a background check on Mike, he's got a litany of criminal problems.
Shocker. Yeah.
He was mostly interested about the car, the 57 Chevy that was in the...
I think he just wanted to buy the car.
That was what his he was mostly concerned about. Huh.
We want to know what kind of relationship Mike had with your dad, if any.
I don't know if there was any.
But didn't he tell you... He thought our dad was dead in the house.
That he did
seemed
say
awfully
that,
strange
he
to
did
me.
Say
Why
that.
Would you think that? I don't know.
I definitely want to spend time trying to find Mystery Mike, but we have so much more to learn from Chuck's family at this moment. This Mike guy, it sounds like he may know something. Maybe something police should know. Anyway, Mystery Mike's visit to Brian's house got things rolling, and I want to know how the first few days played out as the family realized their dad was missing.
So we met down there, and then we waited for the cops because we didn't want to just go breaking into his house, basically. Because we kind of had an idea of his living conditions, you know, so we just wanted to get the cops there and everything first. They got there and said, well, go ahead and go in and search. And we basically had to pry our way into the back door and search around in there with flashlights because there was still electricity in the house, but basically no lamps or light bulbs or anything that I remember. So we searched in the dark, just did like a quick search. We didn't think he was in there, but we didn't think it was really a good enough search. So we went back the next day and then basically searched the whole house.
Was it light enough for you guys to see in the house during the day?
And that's when we took pictures and stuff like that. We could see pretty well, and going back to where they say they found him, We all stood right there because he was like addicted to watching TV, recording shows. He'd always have multiple TVs set up and constantly recording stuff. So that was pretty much his life when he was at home, is watching TV. So that's like we knew that's the spot, you know, where he would be. It's kind of the first spot we went to. We go there and we look and it's like, well, he's not here. And then we started searching everywhere else. And again, that's where they say they found him. He wasn't there that day, in my opinion.
And he's not in our pictures. I mean, if you blow him up and look inch by inch, and there's just nothing.
Susan pulled me aside and showed me the cell phone photos inside Chuck's house, the photos they took when they first tried looking for him. I'm going to get really into what I saw in those photos and how they say so much about Chuck later in this episode. But first, I want to know how much effort police put into trying to find him.
So you guys are absolutely convinced when you looked through there, went through there on February 14th and the next day, February 15th, you didn't see any remains or anything.
We were able to get into the basement. The basement was flooded. The basement was pretty bad, so I was kind of convinced he could still be in the basement, maybe.
And we were all still convinced, like, well, he's not here, so where is he? Maybe he's got dementia and he's walking the streets, or, you know, maybe he's in a hospital.
And do you know if the police go in there? Did they actually go in there?
Okay, so something
that's
I want to tell
whole
you
thing too.
There was supposedly a wellness check done. Yeah. Or so it was supposed to be done, and did you look into that?
We can see. In fact, I'm going to go to my bag real quick.
Inside my bag, I have a piece of paper. It's a one-page report we got from the Denver Police Department showing how many times police dispatch documented police activity at Chuck's home. It's called a Calls for Service Report. I put it out in front of me, along with the photos of Chuck scattered on the table.
You don't know if police actually went in there then.
I don't know if Murray, okay. Detective Bruce Gibbs told me that they did, but he said that was right before that last search when they found him. But I don't think anybody else was out there.
That's something we'd really love to know, is like how much searching did police do?
The dispatch report tells us officers visited Chuck's property 5 times between the time he was declared missing and when he was finally found dead in his living room. 5 times in that 1 year and 10 day period. We don't know what police did or maybe didn't do. I wonder what Chuck's kids know.
Yeah, 5 calls, 5 times police visited the house, never went inside, or maybe they did, but they didn't find your dad.
And the last time, just recently when they did find him, they said they were gonna meet there at 8 o'clock. I got the call at like 12 o'clock, said they found him. So that's 4 hours. And I'm sure I wasn't the first one they called. So I think they went in the house and found him almost immediately.
One of the big questions that we have is what initiated that spark by police to go in there?
Well, I was talking to Detective Binet about the case. And there were a lot of times where I would call and he would not even return my calls. I must admit that. But I did talk to him shortly before that last search. And he said, you know, we're gonna get this. Well, it started with the city, because the city was going out there and they were wanting the house cleaned up. They were like, this is a big problem. We gotta do something about that. And he started working with the like environmental people.
Environmental
Health Department and them. And so he started working with them, and that's what kind of coordinated that search as well. Because he told me, he said, you know, we gotta do something about this. I still can't rule out that he's not in the house. So I know he was behind that as well. So so it's kind of hearsay, like I don't know.
But on the flip side, what's difficult for us is we want to know who did what and did they follow a protocol. We know that the police department didn't at the very least make the effort to go and to talk to the neighbors. We know that because the neighbors we talked to said police never came to us. You would think that would be like the next step. Check bank records. Check his financials, see if he's spending money.
Yeah, see if he has it. Yeah, exactly. That's what we wanted to know.
I think it's very possible that he came back later after we searched and maybe he died in the house.
You think your dad was coming and going?
Maybe. I mean, it's a possibility.
But then when the autopsy comes back and says he's been gone for 2 years, then we're like, well, maybe that's...
Well, it hasn't been quite, though. Yeah. I know that for sure. Because I last talked to him probably in June of 2016.
It's like, if they could have checked his bank account, it seemed like that would have been real simple to say, well, yeah, he's taking money out and he's paying Motel 6 over here. Yeah. I went to his house one day to check on things, and I go in the backyard and there's a grocery bag with a bowling ball and a bike helmet in the bag.
A bowling ball and a bike helmet.
And he had bowling balls in his house and bike helmets. So that to me looks like something he would have taken out of the trash or something.
The bag looked like he was wrapped around a handlebar on a bike.
Yeah, the top of the bag was all twisted up and
like he was carrying it on a handlebar.
Carrying it, yeah.
Initially, when we first went into the house, the first thing we found were $100 bills scattered all over the kitchen.
What?
Mixed in with the trash and everything. Wow. Half of them were half eaten by mice and rats and stuff. So I would think that no strangers had probably been in the house
for a while.
The first time you guys went in the house,
the very first night.
Yeah.
And the second day, we found $100 bills just right there, and you'd have to pass through that. It's the only way to get into that house. So I don't think anyone was in that house besides him prior to us searching. After we found out he was missing, I'm not sure. Someone went in the house. He wasn't there when we searched. If he was buried, 100% completely buried, which seems hard for me to believe that there would have been no evidence there.
Did they ever do a formal interview with him?
No, we've never talked to a cop.
No, I have. Well, I did. And the day we were there,
I talked to him.
But it was.
But did they ever take statements from you guys sitting down?
He didn't handwrite nothing.
He did handwrite some stuff the first day that they found the body, because I went and introduced myself, found the detective. We sat down in his car and he took some notes.
Granted, when he went missing, we filed the report and we put some missing signs up around the neighborhood. Yeah. So maybe that was enough.
We weren't convinced that he was dead.
You guys actually tried to find some sort of like footprints.
We weren't convinced that he was dead right away. We're like, maybe he's,
I thought he got pushed out of the house. Like he just couldn't live there because there's no running water, the heat, it's winter, there's rats. And at some point I thought maybe he was just like, I'm gonna go buy a camper and live in that over here in the field or something.
Here you are as a family. You had a very difficult relationship with your father. He passes, and then now you're all having to kind of like literally pick up the pieces of his life again. Yeah. It's gotta be hard for you guys.
Yes. It's tough. It's
stressful.
I think it's just more weird, we didn't really have a really good relationship, and now we're trying to, like you said, not really put the pieces back together, but trying to find some kind of closure. A lot of these pictures, I look at them, I'm like, man, I didn't even know that guy then, or I didn't know him then either, I wasn't around. So it's kind of hard, to relate to him when I didn't even know him really.
We left a note in the house, cause like, if you come back, Dad, we're looking for you. Give us a call, all this stuff. So we never thought twice that if he came back home, that he would not contact us. Never thought to research the house because he knew we were looking for
it. I'd like to know if the note is still there.
I'd like to know that too.
Okay, now to those photos Susan has on her phone, photos they took when they first started looking for their dad. Describing what I saw is a little hard, but I'm going to try for a second here. The photos show a living room, but instead of a couch and television, it looks like a garbage truck just dumped huge piles of trash inside. I don't mean to sound insensitive here, but that's how it looked. I could see large dunes of debris. The piles of stuff nearly touched the ceiling. There was a bit of light in the room, but it was dark because garbage covered a window. I've covered extreme hoarding cases before when I was a reporter in Albuquerque. The city there would declare homes nuisances because they would attract rodents and other pests that would eventually invade other homes. I can say, based on my experience, Chuck's case is probably the worst hoarding case I have ever seen. It seems Chuck was a prisoner held captive by his mental illness. Even when he was alive, he was really lost at home. Do you guys know what sort of mental health conditions he may have been diagnosed with?
I went to a counselor with him at one time because he had asked me to go, and he had ADHD, he had the hoarding, anxiety, depression, and OCD, and OCD for sure was a big one.
OCD.
They tried to work with him and throw a piece of paper away in the garbage, and he got really, really bad anxiety, and he couldn't do it. And it was just like McDonald's bag or receipt or something.
And he was a really intelligent person, so there's no way you're going to tell him that he's wrong.
And as children, it must be difficult for you to try and have a relationship with your dad when your dad's like that. I would think that would be totally
tough.
Especially since, like I said, he was, a lot of times he was mean and verbally abusive with us growing up. So when we got older, he'd come around and he tried to, keep us in his life and stuff. Yeah. And he wasn't as mean then, but you don't forget those things, So we never really had that close bond with him.
Yeah.
Which could have led to this hoarding thing too. I don't know, the loneliness and the depression.
Probably have some great memories of your dad growing up, right? Kind of?
I have.
You're shaking your head, Kevin.
I don't.
No?
I don't have any.
No?
Not really.
None?
I have one good memory of my dad. And that's when we were sitting on the side of a mountain. We'd just been hunting all morning. The sun finally was getting to where we're not freezing to death, you know? And we sat there and had some breakfast and we're eating like these little cherry pie things that he used to carry, you know, eat all the time, and like the yogurt or pudding or something. We were cracking jokes and he was smiling, and then that memory fades away and it's all bad after that. That's all I have.
And that's
it. Really, that's the only memory I have of me and my dad even getting along.
Susan, what are your, do you have a good memory of your father?
I don't really remember. Like, I guess my mom told me he used to babysit me when I was real little before these guys were born and stuff, and that he was pretty good with me and stuff. I don't remember that. So not a whole lot from childhood, but My good memories of my dad were after, like, you know, when he would come over for Christmas and stuff like that. When we were adults and he was aging and he was trying to
make amends,
I guess, maybe. As we got older, I kind of just more felt sorry for him more than anything. I always felt sorry for him after I learned his, you know, all of his problems and his, you know, his being lonely and being in that house living like that. And I knew he was a hoarder. He told me, he admitted that he had the problem, but I never saw it. He just told me about it, but he'd never let me in there to see it.
What about you, Jeff? You got any good memories of your dad?
I'd say I have a lot of good memories, but they're just as many bad ones. Like, he'd take us boating, he'd take us hunting, he'd take us skiing.
Yeah, skiing.
I mean, we did all kinds of fun stuff. And a lot of times they started out good, but then he'd lose his temper and then it turns into a bad memory. I say there's good and bad, because he'd be joking around, we'd have a good time, and then next thing you know, it's a bad memory.
I have a good memory of my dad. He used to play Mastermind with me all the time. And that was, I remember doing that with him a lot, and that was our thing. We never was upset. It was a good time.
I get the sense you guys are pretty close. I mean, as brother and sister, brothers. And
I think it's because of the way we grew up that we had to stick together, and we always watched each other's back. You know, because we had to stick together all the time.
I'm quickly getting the sense here Chuck was a difficult person. He pushed his family away, his mental illnesses, his hoarding, all of that stuff became an obstacle. And then I begin to hear from them about Chuck's life. The pictures of him before us show him smiling as a younger man. One of them is a black and white wedding photo, a happy, good-looking couple. Chuck is smiling. But as he gets older, the photos change. His face changes, not much smiling anymore, more stoic looks. I wonder how this young, happy man became reclusive. A loner, missing, forgotten, and then dead among the piles of debris.
He retracted from society, right?
He essentially was a real loner. Yes.
What do you think, like, you know, with mental health, I'm no mental health expert by any means, but why do you think your dad suffered this way, with these mental illness issues? What do you think was the spark, or was he born with it, or was there something that happened?
His parents. We've come to find that he had a real rough upbringing. Really? And his parents were a lot like him.
Yeah.
OCD, not so much hoarding.
His mom especially.
Probably not so much the hoarding, right? But the physical, mental abuse.
His dad was an alcoholic, so his dad wasn't around very much. He used to drink all the time.
You know, they'd beat him and make him stay in the basement, and
he did not have a good relationship with his mom. I knew that all along. He would say he didn't like her very much.
Yeah, your dad sounds like he was very short-tempered and very mean. But behind that is a great deal of suffering.
That's why I said when I first went in the house, I was like, man, I wish he would have just came and told me or, you know, something, tried to communicate with me. I would have took him in.
Did your dad work?
He was a welder at one time, but the last 20 years.
He was a teacher, too.
Disability.
He was a teacher?
For science a couple
teacher.
Years.
He was a science teacher?
For 2 years.
I think a lot of it.
He's smart. Like we said, he's an intelligent guy.
He's a really smart guy, and that's why you're not going to tell him anything.
Then he went to work with my mom's dad as a welder, and he did that for a long time, but it got to the point where his mental problems, he couldn't get to work. He couldn't hold down a job.
He couldn't just keep stable.
And he worked at the dog track. That was
He would do that for years. He worked part time at the dog track. He started in high school, and he did that all the whole time we were growing up.
I remember when he got hurt his knee. That's when he just started watching TV like crazy.
Well, I think he got beat up at work. He got into a fight with somebody one time, right? And I think that might have messed him up.
Well, he's told me several times that he's been hit in the head. He got hit in the head. His high school kid was pounding his head in the cement. Another time he said he got in some little tiff with the cop, and the cop hit his head on the top of a car. And he said it. So there's been several times where he said he's been hit in the head, and he actually thinks that that was part of why he was the way he was.
We found an old police report from the late 90s that mentions Chuck. Arvada police pulled him over for a traffic violation and found he had the wrong plates on his car. When cops approached him, the report paints a picture that Chuck wasn't having it. He got pissed, blew up about a potential ticket, and called one of the cops a prick. Police physically removed him from the car for an arrest. I showed his kids the police report. Jeff read through it, shook his head with a smirk, and said, "That's so dad."
Well, I guess I can say he's gone now.
Yeah.
He used to have me draw registration tags. And he'd make sure I did it perfect.
He's like,
yeah, and we'd go out and tape them onto the license plates.
Kevin's memories of his dad are not fond. It sounds like he got the worst of it as the oldest boy.
When I was a kid, I used to have to come home from school, and this is like old VCR technology where it'd have like the number 00768 or something on it, and I'd have to start that recording. 00768 and record to 00892. Take the tape out, put a different tape in, check the number, make sure I don't record it over anything that he wants to watch that he hasn't seen yet. And that would be my life, switching tapes out and watching, and changing channels, and he'd have a schedule for me to program and watch all this shit.
And if him. He screwed it up, or my mom screwed it up.
If I did something wrong, that, I would get my ass whooped.
Really? Yeah.
He whooped my ass for that.
Yeah, my mom was having to do that too for him, because he'd
so
have to be at work.
You would have to like record all of these shows in a certain
And not even shows, 10 seconds of a show, 15 seconds of a clip.
A
commercial. I mean, random things.
And he would just come down hard on you. If
and
you
he
did
would.
Wrong.
Oh, man.
Oh yeah.
He was.
If it didn't get done right.
My mom got it pretty bad too. I remember standing in the hallway with a baseball bat, just waiting for him to walk down the hall so I could finish it. You know, I was just gonna let him have it.
Did he hit your mom?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just sit there and wait for him to come down the hall, and he would just like he knew that I was waiting for him. You know, because he'd never come. I think she kind of washed her hands with it 30 years ago when they got divorced. You know,
they probably haven't even spoken.
Yeah, it's kind of just a faded memory to her now. You know, she's moved on. So,
Did she attend? Did she go to the funeral?
She said, you know, it's just unfortunate that we have to be stuck here cleaning up his mess now. You know, that's what she's a little upset with him for. But.
Towards the end of our talk, I get the sense Susan, the only girl and the oldest child, had more patience for her father's mental problems. And despite only talking with him every few months, it sounds like she had the most contact with him. In-person visits would only happen around the holidays like Christmas.
That's probably the last Christmas we had with him. He liked to talk, and he would not listen. So he would go on and on and on for 4 hours and not let you get a word in edgewise. So it was no fun talking to him. He would just ramble on and rant and rave about stuff.
He would talk about the same thing every time I talked to him for 15 years. The same. Remember that one time?
We don't know what happened to my dad. And with all the people that have been, you know, rummaging through his stuff, what if something did happen? What if a crime was committed and that person's gonna get away with it, you know?
Yeah, because
It's possible he had a temper. Yeah, it's possible he got in a fight with somebody and they dumped him there, or they got in a fight in the house, or who knows, and they're just gonna walk away. I mean.
And if he was buried, I think somebody would have had to physically bury him.
I know, because he's been there for so long, it's hard to know what happened, but. Maybe if it would have, found him a year ago, maybe we would have had a little more information on what happened.
I feel like we are just getting started on this series. Once we find one answer, we have more questions. Like, what did police do when they were first called to Chuck's home? What about the city agency that handles hoarding cases? What did they do? What's next? Coming up, we are going to talk with Denver Police and the Department of Public Health and Environment. We've got loads of questions for them, and we'd like to answer your questions too. Go to Facebook. We have a group called Blame Podcast. Get in there, talk with us. See you on the next episode of Blame, Lost at Home.